Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on September 10th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a professor of law at the University of Maryland, Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And Frank, today we welcome Wendy Parmet, the Matthews Distinguished University Professor of Law, Professor of Public Policy and Urban Affairs, Director of the Program on Health Policy and Law, and Associate Dean for Interdisciplinary Education and Research Support at Northeastern University School of Law. She's also a leading expert on health, disability, and public health law, and just a brilliant scholar. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you so much. It's really a thrill to be with you today.
So, Frank, just to tie up a few loose ends or to mention a couple of very quick developments, I think health law is a little quiet at the moment, but there are a few things that we should point out to our listeners. The first one I really haven't dug deeply into at all, but we do have a new notice of proposed rulemaking on a revised common rule. And that has new informed consent provisions, increased security, privacy, and confidentiality, and overall a sort of a broader reach. Now, friends of the show at Harvard's Bill of Health blog are going to be holding a mini symposium online on this. So I'm going to be attending that, and I hope the rest of you watch out for it. The second thing is there's a health affairs piece just published by Daniel Hogan and colleagues on the impact of health insurance. Now, I suppose we've taken it as a matter of faith that since health insurance is the gateway to healthcare in our country, and the primary purpose of the Affordable Care Act was to increase access by increasing the availability and affordability of health insurance, I guess we always assume that health insurance translates to healthier persons. Well, this study actually looks at that, quote, insurance effect, and found that in diabetes, high cholesterol, and hypertension, there was clearly an insurance effect with improved management and control of the conditions. The caveat, which I thought was interesting, is that this tends to suggest that as we increase insurance, we're going to have increasing demand for healthcare services and healthcare spending on chronic diseases.
Yes, that's a very interesting line of effects that I think we could be seeing out of the expansion of coverage, and I'll definitely be keeping close tabs on that. I've got a few openers as well this week, Nick, but your mentioning of the Bill of Health blog actually reminded me that I would like to recommend to all the listeners the Bill of Health blog discussion back from August, actually on the role of pain and the measurement of pain in American healthcare, and particularly in the disability system. It was organized by my colleague Amanda Pastilnik, and she had some terrific cross-disciplinary dialogue between doctors, attorneys, and social scientists there. So highly recommended. In terms of my news for the week, one of the two stories I just wanted to call attention to was the Wall Street Journal article about insurers winning big health rate increases. We're seeing lots of states requests and a granting of the requests for major increases in premiums, such as in Tennessee, Blue Cross Blue Shield getting a 36.3% increase. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this rolling wave of increases affects, say, the politics of the Affordable Care Act going into 2016. So something I'm keeping an eye on.
Do you think that's a function of differential state regulation, that some state insurance laws provide greater substantive powers, or maybe they just have stronger enforcement or stronger regulators? Because when one reads occasionally about California being able to push back on those kinds of increases.
You know, the role of the states as laboratories of health reform is such a rich one right now. I was just listening to the health affairs briefing on the California Medicaid waiver and some of the innovative things they're doing out there. I cannot, though, hazard a guess as to that, Nick. I wish I could, but I will be reading the testimony of some folks that recently were before Congress on exactly this issue, because I think Congress is starting to get into worry mode about health insurer consolidation, and they're definitely going to be looking at that as a potential driver of these types of rate increases as well.
All right, well, I'm heading off to Texas now. Do you remember Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas? That's where we had that first fatality during the Ebola outbreak. If you recall, there were reports that he was misdiagnosed. Also, their two nurses were infected. Well, they've recently published an expert panel report on that whole thing. And it really makes for very interesting reading. Some of it clearly is, and Wendy, you, no doubt this will interest you, clearly some of it is public health related questions about just what is the relationship between the CDC and providers, who's actually sort of running the show, and is there an over-reliance perhaps on providers for CDC sort of helicoptering in and solving their problems. But the other observations which were really quite interesting were standard sort of health care problems, lack of interprofessional teamwork, fragmentation of care, and really difficult and quite subtle questions about electronic health records, how they were both being sort of over-relied on and how then their poor structures were actually leading to problems. So it's a rather interesting report and worth taking a look at. And then finally, still in Dallas, Politico this week reported a rumor that the FTC is taking a very hard look at the Texas Medical Board and its possible anti-competitive activities. So recall, Frank, our prior discussions with Bill Sage and the North Carolina teeth whitening case that we dealt with on the back to school special and so on. So I think quite a lot more to watch there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's going to be something to watch closely. And also thinking about consolidation and markets and the regulation of markets, the AMA released a study actually a couple days ago saying that the proposed mergers, the mergers of Anthem Cigna and of Aetna Humana, that these would diminish competition in many areas across the country. And this is just one of those areas, again, where the ongoing consolidation of the industry, more proposed consolidations, are going to get a lot more attention. I will be linking to this and to the other things we mentioned on the show page, because I think trying to get clear about the effects of, say, mega insurers on the overall health market will be really important to health policy over the next year or so. And so with that, that's our sort of update on some of the news of the week in health law. Now I want to transition to get into a conversation with Wendy, who writes in so many relevant areas right now, areas that are really at the top of health policymakers' concerns. And I think maybe we'll start today with Wendy's work with respect to immigration and healthcare. And I know you've been thinking a lot about this issue, Wendy, about to the degree to which, for example, those who are undocumented maybe be excluded by design, how that can have malign public health consequences that aren't really realized by many of the folks who are pushing for those exclusions. And I'm wondering if you might be able to introduce our listeners to some of your work in this area, the background problems that you've been addressing, and some of the policy directions you'd like to see us go in.
Thank you so much, Frank. Yeah, I've been working in the area of immigration and health for several years now in different ways. And I've come to the conclusion that immigration is really one of the hidden key components to the problems we face with our healthcare system, and actually also our public healthcare system, that when immigration and healthcare mix, some not so good policies emerge, sort of like the storm clouds arise. And, you know, just sort of an anecdote you might remember, one of the things that led me to this realization was, you might recall back in 2009 when President Obama was speaking to Congress on behalf of the, in support of what became the ACA, Congressman Joe Wilson from South Carolina shattered the decorum in the joint session of Congress by shouting out to the president, "You lie." Well, the "you lie" comment was in response to Obama's pledge that undocumented immigrants would not receive coverage under the ACA. In 2009, that was the summer of those town hall meetings and the angry mobilization and the Tea Party mobilization against the ACA. Much of that was actually about immigration and the fear that immigrants were going to be covered. And so actually, it seems to me that our health insurance problem in this country, if we could call it that, or our access problem is to a very significant degree, I'm certainly not saying wholly, but is to a significant degree related to immigration. And then when we understand how we think about immigrants and health and public health, we really can understand what's going on in health policy. So I've been looking at this both in the health access area, but also the public health area. I just finished a book-length project with my colleague at Northeastern, Patricia Illingworth, who's in the philosophy department. And we explore in that book the various intersections between health, health policy, health law, and immigration, actually both in the U.S. and globally, and try to also develop some normative arguments about this and try to present an argument why basing health policy on immigration status is really problematic, both from a public health policy perspective and a normative perspective.
Ah, I see. And I wanted to follow up on the philosophical and normative ideas about the right to health care and accessing health care here, tying it in actually to the work of a couple of our other show guests, Nathan Cortez and Glenn Cohen, who've written about sort of this idea of patients with passports, people going around the world to try to seek out, say, cheaper medical care than what they get at home or better medical care than what they get at home. But I have a sense that your primary focus has been on the individuals that are, say, in the would be in the bottom income brackets when they move from, say, one place to another. And it seems to me that that's certainly some of the concern driving the, in Europe, the refusal of the Syrian refugees. There's almost a lifeboat mentality that says in this era of austerity, we don't have enough money and we're not going to be able to pay for the health. We can barely pay for the health care and the services of folks who are in the country, and how can we pay for more? And I'm wondering, do you think that that is based on, say, a misunderstanding of some waste that's in the current healthcare system that could be eliminated to, say, provide care for others, or an inadequate appreciation of, say, the malleability of resource flows, where we now assume that the healthcare sector has to be a certain size of the economy, but actually it could be larger, and that could in turn lead to greater prosperity and growth for everyone? Or are there other arguments that maybe I, as someone not as attuned to the philosophical literature, would know?
Well, I think you're very right about the issues that are raised, and also that my perspective has really been focused primarily on people, populations that are less advantaged, although we do talk about medical tourism in our work, but probably in a somewhat different way. I think that there's no doubt anti-immigration fervor around the world is in part related to concern about healthcare resources. And it's also probably true and interesting that the nations of the world, many of the nations which are the most generous in terms of healthcare to their own citizens, are the least generous to immigrants, right? So that you know, there's some correlation between homogeneity and a willingness to redistribute, which I think is descriptively accurate. I don't know that it's causal, but it's certainly an interesting phenomenon we see around the world. Part of what we try to argue in this, in our book, is, and in an article that came out last spring in Public Health Ethics, is that that correlation is not, does not provide a philosophical or normative argument for limiting immigration or limiting access to healthcare to immigrants. That the argument, which is sometimes made on the basis of sort of that solidarity requires that healthcare be provided to people who are citizens or like the people who are already in a country. And we argue actually that solidarity does not require that, and that actually solidarity in health in particular should be understood as arising from the fact that, one, in many ways with respect to health, we're all in this together, that health is significantly a global good, that health affects are transnational. Certainly when we talk about things like the social determinants of health, that there are obligations and duties that are transnational and certainly that transcend visa categories and citizenship categories, but also in a much more grounded way in community. You know, if we think about health at the community level, immigrants make a very large share of our healthcare workforce in the U.S. and in many developed countries. The sort of us-them idea that runs through some of this public discourse about immigrants and health is just not, you know, doesn't reflect the reality of people's experience at a community level in a very grounded way with respect to health. We are providing health to each other. We are sharing fates. We're sharing overcrowded hospital rooms. And so we make arguments grounded both in just basis on justice and on solidarity for providing immigrants with health. That's the normative argument. I do want to mention something of the policy argument, which is immigrants tend to actually be healthier than non-immigrants. And that is a phenomenon that's true across the West. Immigrants are actually important to the vitality of the healthcare system. You know, they are, to many Western countries, they provide a more youthful workforce that helps support healthcare, that provides resources for healthcare. So the argument that immigrant populations are going to create enormous burdens on the healthcare systems, it's just not an argument that's empirically borne out at large. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, particular migrant crises in particular places at particular times doesn't create strains on resources. Of course it does. But if we look at it from a larger macro perspective, immigration is actually critical to maintaining the resources for healthcare, especially in Western Europe, but also in the U.S.
Let's push a little bit further down the solidarity tracks and the contrast with individualism that you tackled along with our friend Lindsay Wiley, who I'm happy to have just written a piece with as well, and of course our good friend Peter Jacobson. And in this piece, you refute the sort of nanny state rhetoric that is sort of thrown at a lot of public health regulation. The article, which is a short one, but is a spectacular sort of 10,000 feet look at the issues of public health law. There are some eminently quotable pieces I particularly liked. Quote, "We should be careful to specify that the debate over public health paternalism is not about what government may do, but rather what government should do." I wonder if you could take us through sort of the anti-rhetoric arguments that you make in that piece.
Thank you. I should say, you know, Lindsay and Peter and I have been working on a series of different papers about the nanny state critique, and the paper you quote, and it's just wonderful to work with them, is a short version of that. We've each also done individual papers, and I had one out in the Connecticut Law Review last year and another one that I'm completing now. I think there are two different points that I want to emphasize. One is that it's important to separate out the legal question from the normative question from the policy question, and that in the nanny state critique, all those three different issues often get conflated. So we see sort of the libertarian nanny state critique go from, this is interfering in individual liberty, it's the nanny state, government shouldn't do it, to government can't do it. And so part of what we're trying to do is separate that out. One, you know, there's a legal question where public health powers remain quite broad, and the constitutional arguments that are made against most public health powers still lose more often than not. There's the normative question about whether a particular infringement on liberty is legitimate. And then there's the, should health departments do this? And part of what I've often been saying, and we also say in this, well, criticizing the nanny state critique is public health authorities need to be careful and wise and judicious and not necessarily exercise all the power they have just because you can do something. And just because it even might be normatively justifiable doesn't mean it's a smart thing to do. The arguments, the normative arguments about liberty, though, to me are ultimately, at the end of the day, the most interesting. And one theme that I've been working on, we talk about in that article, and I've been exploring in my other papers, is this, the idea that we should recognize, at least in some circumstances, public health laws as exercises, and health laws, as exercises of self-governance. And that if we take the population approach and the population level perspective, then laws that are protecting public health are not necessarily laws that are limiting. They're not just laws that limit individual liberty, but they're actually laws that populations and communities enact to enhance their own health. Because sometimes, often, with various health issues, we can't protect ourselves. We need to, in a sense, use law as a way, as a population, to protect our own health. And so we need to get out of that purely individualistic paradigm and understand public health law as a manifestation of self-governance. At the same time, I also like to argue that that argument and that the self-governance rationale means that we need to take self-governance seriously. If public health law is what communities do, to paraphrase the old IOM statement, to protect themselves, then public health officials need to take community engagement and democracy seriously. And public health law really ought, in most cases, to come bottom up rather than top down.
So are the vaccination disputes related to that? I mean, I think part of what you're saying really is that we have to identify ourselves as individuals in the herd, and it's the herd's rights that we are pushing for as individuals.
Absolutely, in the sense that we cannot protect ourselves to a satisfactory degree from many infectious diseases if we're just left on our own, right? We need to think about infectious disease, but also many non-infectious diseases at a population level. And that means, right, if I want the liberty to be free from smallpox or measles, then I only can get that liberty by living in a community in which we all undertake to vaccinate ourselves. On the other hand, again, the self-governance argument does mean that there may be situations in which just because a public health official thinks it's a good idea to impose a regulation, they need to be careful and realize that where a community does not necessarily support that regulation, where it's not coming from the population's concerns, that regulation may not actually have normative justification.
And one of the other things that I want to bring up to sort of tie this show and your work, Wendy, to some of the other discussions we had earlier this year on the podcast, was the comparison between a public health frame about the collective and the more individualistic frame of improving health via, say, corporate wellness programs. And one of the things that I think is so interesting as a normative point to explore when we're thinking about paternalism versus liberty or these other classic polarized oppositions is it seems as though to the extent that we don't have public health measures that, say, are preventing the spread of very unhealthy food or marketing to children of very unhealthy food, we just are going to see necessarily the rise of the corporate nanny state, the corporate nanny in the form of the wellness program that is trying to use various programs to induce people to have more exercise, to eat less, or to do whatever the latest efforts are there. And I guess my question might be, although please feel free to respond on any level of this, my comment here would be, do you think that the corporate wellness programs exist in a tension with the public health frame, or do you foresee a future where public health activists and scholars try to fold in corporate wellness programs and make them part of a broader movement?
I think there is a tension. It may be a healthy tension. And I think there's certainly a place in public health, certainly for private action. Public health does not have to be, you know, I talk about populations. I don't like to use the public or the state when I don't need to, because I think we do need to recognize that populations can work at different levels and within the private sector. And I also believe that populations and individuals relate. Individuals exist and relate and live in and inhabit populations and have responsibilities to the populations to which they belong. So, you know, if we think that individuals should be vaccinated as a matter of responsibility and reciprocity to their population, well, maybe to do certain healthy behaviors. What worries me about the wellness programs, and I have lovely conversations with my wonderful colleague, Kristen Madison, who's written so much about them, is, you know, one are the issues of discrimination and stigma and privacy and the human rights and civil liberties concerns about wellness programs. But sticking from the public health perspective, we need to be careful that we don't over-individualize health problems. I mean, the role of individual choice in many non-communicable diseases is often overstated. It's certainly overstated in the popular imagination. We'd like to think in the U.S. that we can control our fate. We've probably all seen the situation, you know, somebody gets cancer and somebody says, how could that happen? He was so healthy, you know, he exercised. Well, we don't have as much control over our individual fate as we'd like to believe. And when we focus on that, to the detriment of thinking about population-level issues, social determinants, the state of the environment, we could go on and on, then we are creating the same kind of illusion that we rely on when we think we can solve our health problems by keeping immigrants out. These public health problems are often best addressed at a population level. And my concern about wellness programs, therefore, is, you know, there's a role for them, but they are not the solution to non-communicable diseases or chronic diseases, and they are not the solution to our healthcare costs. If I could do a shameless plug here, by the way, at Northeastern, we're going to have a major conference on exactly this issue, the tension between individual choice and collective action in public health next April. And I will post information about that on Bill of Health and other places. And I invite everyone to come and join us and explore these issues, which I think really are critical to how we think about public health policy and health policy.
And I think just to follow up, Wendy, I wanted to ask a question about your recent publication on e-cigarettes. There's been a great deal of controversy over them, coming down to, you know, the very basic factual questions of whether they substitute for more dangerous activity or maybe lead into or somehow prime people for the more dangerous activity of smoking. Could you give us a sense of what the state of play is there and your perspective on it?
Absolutely. And I should just say I'm interested in it for the reasons we've talked about earlier, because I think it's a really interesting case to think about the deep normative issues that run through public health policy. And the reason e-cigarettes are so interesting is for the reason you just stated. We don't really know whether they're dangerous or helpful, right? We don't know whether they're going to make the situation better or worse vis-a-vis population health. The evidence, and, you know, there's a lot of studies being done now, some of questionable quality, not surprisingly. The evidence seems clear that, you know, if I had to today to use an e-cigarette or smoke a cigarette, I'm better off using an e-cigarette. That seems clear. But that's really not the question, because the question really is, at a population level over time, are we going to get more or less disease? Will e-cigarettes be a gateway drug, or will they be an effective form of harm reduction? And so there's a tension here around the e-cigarettes between, you know, two different themes in public health policy: the harm reduction approach, which we of course use with HIV and needle exchanges and opioids and all kinds of issues, and the precautionary principle, the do no harm, the, you know, regulate before you know. So we have that tension here with e-cigarettes. What's happening right is that hundreds of cities have enacted ordinances and regulations to apply many of their indoor smoking laws to e-cigarettes. In a piece I've just finished, I talk about that as those laws as actions of self-governance, and where communities are really choosing to adopt a precautionary approach. But the big issue is right now is we are waiting for the FDA to act. The Tobacco Control Act, the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, enables the FDA to regulate e-cigarettes if the FDA deems them to be subject to regulation under the Act. And in April 2014, the FDA issued, the FDA published a notice of proposed rulemaking of the so-called deeming regulations that would, in fact, deem all tobacco products, with some exceptions not relevant to the current conversation, to be subject to regulation. And if the FDA, in fact, goes ahead and promulgates these regulations, e-cigarettes will be subject to the Act, and many of the provisions of the Tobacco Control Act will be applicable. Some of them are completely non-controversial. For example, ingredient listing, right? Manufacturers would be required to tell the FDA what their ingredients are, barring sales to minors. There are lots of things that would go into effect to the regulatory in the regulatory regime, which pretty much everybody seems to be on board. But there are some provisions in the deeming regulations that might have a impact, might have the effect of inhibiting the growth of e-cigarettes, which may be great from a population health perspective, but it may be harmful from a population health perspective. And that's one of the issues I explore in my work. Late last spring, the House Appropriations Committee put language into the FDA appropriations that would limit the impact of some of these regulations by basically changing the pre-market review provisions. And so preventing e-cigarette manufacturers that are already in business from having to get, in effect, prior licensing from the FDA. That's one of the provisions that would come into effect and would be very inhibitory to e-cigarettes. The Appropriations Committee did that. Of course, we have no idea what's going to happen with appropriations. We don't know if Congress is going to ever pass any appropriations this year. So it's still very much in play what will happen at the federal level.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Wendy Parmet for joining us. Thanks, Wendy.
My pleasure. It's really fun to talk with you.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank?
I'm at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.